complete, since quantum states can be localized either in Q or in P, but not in both of them. So the main idea that I want to present, it is that maybe it is not the case that quantum description is incomplete, but rather that classical description is not objective. So what does this mean? Well, this requirement of objectivity means that some kind of gauge-dependent element should not be mistaken as objective by the theory. Well, I want to argue that the coordinate Q and the momenta P cannot be objective properties of the same physical system. That is to say, if P is an objective property, then necessarily Q is gauge dependent. If this were the case, then in classical mechanics, non-objective properties are wrongly considered objective. That is to say, the classical states would include not only the objective properties, but also non-objective elements. On the other hand, in quantum mechanics, quantum states would include only the objective properties of the system. And this would explain why in quantum mechanics we have half the number of coordinates than in classical mechanics. So I'm speaking about objectivity and objective properties. So the idea is that, in a sense, quantum mechanics, contrary to classical mechanics, is a satisfactory theory of physical objects. So what I will do now is to introduce a conceptual presentation of what I understand by physical objects. Well, a physical object is a physical configuration that first is defined by a set of objective properties that allow us to identify the object. Okay? Secondly, a physical object has different aspects or profiles that depend on the relative position between the object and the observer. Okay? These profiles or aspects are not invariant under what I'm calling gauge transformations. For example, if I take a die, I look at the die, I will see a particular number. If I perform a rotation, this number will change. So this is what I mean here by gauge transformation, okay? A rotation of the die or a rotation of the observer relative to the die. I'm sorry? Well, that's the next. What I mean by objective properties is that these properties are invariant under these transformations that permute the aspects or the profiles of the object. Okay? I'm talking in a very, yeah. So that's why I chose the example of the die. You take an object, you look at it, you will see an aspect. If you rotate the object, you will see another aspect. And there are some properties that do not change under these kind of transformations. So it's really roughly speaking. Okay?
What would be one of these properties which doesn't change?
Well, the geometric features of the die are some of the distances or the sum of the numbers. Okay?
It's an objective property that it has one face that says 6. It might not necessarily be the one you're looking at.
I'm sorry?
Is it an objective property that has a face that says 6?
Yeah. Okay.
Are all transformations gauge transformations, or if not?
Well, that is the main point of the whole story, so I will go to that. Okay? So since these transformations, by definition, do not change the objective properties, and since the object is defined by its objective properties, I will call these transformations automorphisms of the object. Okay? So if I do that, I arrive to Bayes' definition, where he says objectivity means invariance with respect to the group of automorphisms. Okay? So this is completely standard, but this definition is not completely satisfactory. Why? Because it is not clearly stated Under what transformations are the objective properties invariant? That is to say, I am defining objective properties as invariants under a certain group of transformations, but I do not have any idea on what this group of transformations is. Okay? In other words, I do not know what are the transformations that permute the different aspects of the object. Okay? So this problem was recognized by some authors, like for example Robert Nozick, where when he says the notion of invariance under transformations cannot, without further supplementation, be a complete criterion of the objectivity of facts, for its application depends upon a selection of which transformations something is to be invariant under. Okay? Or even in various terms, reality may not always give a clear answer to the question what the actual group of automorphisms is for a given object. Okay? So I will now try to give an intuitive argument for justifying my answer to this problem, which is the following. If we take an object that exists in time, a temporal object, this object can be observed at different times. So we could say that temporal evolution is the automorphism that allows us to observe its different temporal profiles. In fact, in classical mechanics, temporal evolution is a canonical transformation generated by the Hamiltonian function. So in a sense, we could say that temporal evolution is a transformation of some kind of reference system from where I'm looking at the object. And at each time, I perceive a temporal profile of the object. On the other hand, if I take an instantaneous object, an object that exists only for an instant, well, such an object cannot be observed at different times. That is to say, it has no temporal profiles. So, in my terminology, I will say that temporal evolution is not an automorphism of this object. Okay? Well, the idea that I am trying to introduce is that, in a sense, it is the object itself that prescribes what are its automorphisms. That is to say, each object, in a sense, tells me what can I do in order to observe different profiles of the object. Is it clear?
It is. No, maybe it's not an appropriate question yet, but where does dynamics come into the story?
I'm sorry?
Where does dynamics come into the story? Is that...
Well, it's the example I gave before. If yeah. I... Dynamics in this sense is nothing but the gauge transformation. Okay? Which is true in classical mechanics, at least for a constant energy.
So what about irreversible dynamics? I mean, there's friction in the real world. Should I consider that? That's not an automorphism.
No. Here, this example is only valid for the case of a system with a constant energy. I will speak about this afterwards. Okay? It's only an example to justify this idea, that it is the intrinsic nature of the object that tells me what are the group of automorphisms that define its objective properties. Okay?
Do you have an independent way of specifying the intrinsic nature of the object? In other words, independent of the set of automorphisms? That's it. How do you characterize the intrinsic nature of the object?
Well,
which is supposed to tell you.
Well, this is what I'm calling intrinsic nature of the object is nothing but the objective properties of the object. That is to say, the postulate it is that the objective properties of an object generate, in some sense, its automorphisms. Okay, so what I am calling intrinsic nature of the object, it is the objective properties that define the object.
So this is irrespective of the object is a subsystem of the universe.
The object?
Is a subsystem of the universe.
Yeah.
So you still claim that the objective properties of the object are completely described by the object with no relation to the rest of the universe?
Well, yes, I am considering any mechanical system that I am describing with a set of coordinates and momenta, so in a sense I am cutting this from the rest.
But let me ask you, I mean, supposing, you know, I have a sphere.
Yeah.
Okay, and I have it in a universe which is very anisotropic. versus I have the ball in the universe, which is completely homogeneous and isotropic. Do they have the same objective properties or no?
Well, if I am interested, it depends on what I'm interested in, on what kind of description I want to perform. Anytime you have a system, you decide what you include in the description and what you let.
So what I'm getting at is a ball in an object in a completely homogeneous isotropic universe.
If you want.
Versus in an anisotropic universe, the question is whether you can give a meaning to its orientation. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry, could I just ask very quickly? So look. According to that, couldn't I say that I'm going back to my dice, and its objective property is the fact that it has a 6 pointing towards me?
That's
so it determines automorphisms that are only rotations that keep that facade facing towards me. If that.
I am saying yes, that the. I think so. That the properties that allow me to say this is a die. In some sense, these properties tell me what are the operations that I can perform in order to observe different numbers. Okay? Well, in order to give sense to this postulate, we have to associate which objective property of the object an operator that generates the corresponding automorphisms. Okay? I am saying that the objective properties generate, in some sense, automorphisms, but an objective property does not generate anything in principle, so I have to define a correspondence between these properties and some kind of operators that generate these operations. Okay? Since these operators are induced by means of the postulate by the objective properties, I will call them eigenoperators to stress this fact. So, well, I just have said, according to this postulate, there should exist a correspondence between the observables that define the objective properties and some kind of operators.
You don't have to go back to the back slide, the previous slide, but I am worried this there is a circularity here, right?
Yeah, it seems, but I will.
Okay.
There is no circularity.
Okay.
But you will see it. It's easy to see. Okay. So let's summarize. I have said that the objective properties of an object are invariant by definition under certain gauge transformations. And I have postulated afterwards that these gauge transformations are generated by the objective properties themselves. Okay? So there is a kind of circularity. The objective properties are invariant under something, but they generate this something. Well, the consequence of these two statements is that an objective property of an object has to be invariant under the transformation generated by all the other objective properties of the same object. Okay? That is to say, an objective property has to be invariant under the gauge transformation generated by the other objective properties. Okay? So let's suppose for a moment, I will justify it later, that the infinitesimal transformation generated by a property G on a property F is given by the Poisson bracket between the two functions. If I accept this, then, if F or G are objective properties of some object, then they have to have zero Poisson bracket. That is to say, F has to be invariant under the object under the transformation generated by G, and G has to be invariant under the transformation generated by F. Okay? Because F is objective, so it has to be invariant under gauge transformations, in particular under the gauge transformation generated by G. In this case, we see that there is no singularity because it's trivial that F has zero Poisson bracket with F. Okay? This means that the set of objective properties of a given object has to define a commutative Poisson algebra. In particular, if P is an objective property of an object, then the coordinate Q cannot also be an objective property, since their Poisson bracket is not zero. In other words, different values of Q are just like different aspects or profiles of such an object. So, if this, in this very rocks sense to ask which position Q is objective in an object with a well-defined momentum P would be as nonsensical as asking which side of the die is the privileged one.
Can I ask you a question about what you mean by equals on the previous? By equals, do you mean
equals
strong, do you mean equals strongly or equals weakly?
Well, here,
yes.
I mean equal in the normal sense of classical mechanics. There are no constraints here. I'm nothing like this. I mean what you mean.
But if it were a constrained system, would that be a weak quality or a strong quality?
Well, I would say that it would be in principle, it would be it would have to be an strong and zero only on the constrained surface because it's the only the relevant information is there. But I don't know. I would have to see. But I would say that it's zero in the sense of the constrained surface. But I do not see the what I go on. So I was saying that to ask which position is objective in an object with a well-defined momentum would be as nonsensical as asking which side of the die is the privileged one. Nevertheless, even if a die has no privileged side, it will show a particular side when thrown. In our case, even if a physical system with a well-defined momentum has no objective position, it will appear in a particular position if a position observation is performed. Nevertheless, this does not mean that the observed position, Q1, was something like the objective position of the system, exactly as in the example of the die. So I will pass now to more formal considerations. I will try now to, in a sense, to isolate what I will call the minimal difference between classical and quantum mechanics. That is to say, I will try to reduce some non-essential difference between both theories in order to arrive to a better comparison. So it is generally stated that classical mechanics differs from quantum mechanics because in quantum mechanics we have operators that act on states. So in order to compare both theories, we have to compare the commutative algebra of classical observables with the non-commutative algebra of quantum operators. Well, in fact, the symplectic formulation of mechanics clearly shows that there exist classical operators associated to classical observables. Moreover, in geometric quantization, quantum operators can be obtained as extensions of classical operators. That is to say, the quantum operator associated to an observable S is nothing but the classical operator plus some corrections. This means that in order to compare both theories, we don't have to compare classical observables with quantum operators, but rather classical operators with quantum operators. Okay? So what do I mean by classical operators? Well, you know, the phase space is a symplectic manifold, and the symplectic form is a kind of antisymmetric metric in the sense that it defines the duality between the cotangent bundle and tangent bundle. In particular, I can take the vector field, which corresponds to the differential of an observable. These vector fields, which are called Hamiltonian vector field, is what I am calling here the classical operator. The relationship between this vector field and the function f is given by this expression, where omega is the symplectic form. And in particular, if I take two classical operators of this kind, I can consider their commutator, which is the Lie derivative of one vector field in the direction defined by the other one. And it is worth stressing that this algebra of classical operator is in general non-commutative. If I take any two vector fields, in general, they will not commute. Well, in the simplest case, the classical operator associated to the function f is given by this expression. And in particular, the classical operators associated to the observables Q and P are minus the derivative in P and the derivative in Q, respectively. This shows that the idea of associating the derivative in Q with the momentum P comes from classical mechanics. Okay? So, well, any any symplectic manifold is always a Poisson manifold. This means that I can define a Poisson structure. We have a correspondence between observables and operators, so the Poisson bracket between two functions is the action of the operator associated to one function on the other function. And this is by definition the least derivative of the function in the direction of the classical operator. And the Jacobi identity warranties that the map between observables and operators is a Lie algebra homomorphism, which means that the classical operator associated to the Poisson bracket is the Lie bracket of the classical operators. And in order to stress that I am not using the word operator in a metaphorical sense, we can compare classical and quantum equations of motion. And we will see that in both equations have exactly the same structure. The temporal derivative of the state is given by the action of the corresponding operator on the corresponding state. The only change is the definition of the state and the particular form of the operator. Well, if I integrate the Hamilton equation, I will obtain the flow of the vector field, which is nothing but the one parameter family of the diffeomorphisms of the phase space. And if the function is a Hamiltonian, this will be the temporal evolution of the system. So till now we have classical observables, we have classical operators, we have a correspondence between these two sets. So what is the problem with this notion of classical operators? Why should I pass to a quantum formulation? This is the question that I want to address now. Well, from the formal point of view, the Lie algebra homomorphism between classical observables and operators is not injective. If I take any constant function, the classical operator is identically zero. This means that the set of classical operators is isomorphic to the set of classical observables modulo the real numbers. Two functions differing in a real number have the same associated classical operator. Well, the fundamental consequence of this fact is that if I take the Lie bracket of the classical operators associated to P and Q, this is by definition the classical operator associated to the Poisson bracket, that is to say the classical operator associated to the constant function 1, that is to say equal to 0. In other words, Q and P have non-zero Poisson bracket, but their associated classical operators commute. And we will see afterwards why this would be problematic. Well, in fact, if we analyze carefully Dirac quantization conditions, we will see that the most important condition, the real new one, is the injectivity. That is to say, if I have a constant function, the associated operator is constant. The other two conditions are only conservative conditions in the sense that they say that things that are valid in classical mechanics go on being true in quantum mechanics. For example, the idea that the map between observables and operators is an homomorphism of Lie algebras is already true in classical mechanics. I'm not changing anything. So we have seen that classical observables play two fundamental roles in mechanics. They can be evaluated on states and used for identifying this state, that is to say they define properties of the states. And on the other hand, classical observables define classical operators that act on states by means of symplectic diffeomorphisms. We have seen that in classical mechanics fails to establish a faithful correspondence between observables and operators. And we have seen that quantum mechanics can be obtained by forcing this faithfulness. Yes.
For a little while here, I've been a little bit worried about exactly your first point here. And the reason is, so that this is pointing out that observables, so observables can be observed, but you also point out they induce these classical operators.
Yeah.
And this is at the heart of the argument.
Yeah.
What worries me is, I think this makes sense to us because we know a lot about quantum mechanics. But if you were making this point to people in 1905 who were thinking about classical mechanics, and you're trying to tell them, well, classical mechanics has a problem with it because of this, they would have simply said, well, there's no logical relation
yeah,
between the ability to observe X
and the transformation that happens, you know, when you do this mathematical thing, you get it, right? So why should I believe that in classical mechanics there should be any connection at all between the observable x and the operator, you know, liberty?
What I am trying to do is to show that classical mechanics does not exist without this relationship. But it's a question of language. If I want to write Hamilton equations in the way I did it, it is clear that, well, classical equations of motion is nothing but the action of an operator on a state. So it's, I'm stressing that by using a particular language, the difference between quantum and classical mechanics can be reduced. That is to say, the idea that the notion of an operator acting on a state is a quantum notion is not true. Okay? So, evidently, we know this because we have learned symplectic geometry and many things which came afterwards. But now we can say that this is not the difference between quantum and classical mechanics, the idea of an operator. What is different is the particular expression of that operator. Okay? So I will try to argue why it is necessary to modify the classical notion of operators. Okay?
So where I was?
Okay. So the question now is, why should this correspondence between observables and operators be faithful? Well, in order to answer, I will consider the symplectic action of any group on a manifold. This such an action is said to be symplectic if it preserves the symplectic form. And in particular, if I have an action of a group on a manifold, there is a map between the Lie algebra of the group and the tangent bundle of the manifold. That is to say, I can take a Lie algebra element and I can define a vector field on the manifold. Okay? I will use the following terminology. I will say that the fundamental vector field on the manifold realizes on the manifold the universal operation in the Lie algebra. Okay? In particular, in mechanics, we are interested in what is called Hamiltonian actions. And a symplectic action is said to be Hamiltonian if there exists a map, which is called a momentum map, between the Lie algebra and the set of classical functions, such that this diagram commutes. This means that instead of passing directly from the Lie algebra to the tangent bundle, we can pass, thanks to the momentum map, from the Lie algebra to the set of classical observables, and to the set of classical observables to the associated operators. So in a sense, what I'm trying to say is that the realization of these universal operators is factorized in some sense through these physical observables.
Is this true classically or quantum or both? Or is this just
this
definition?
I'm sorry?
Definition for Hamiltonian.
This is classical, this is in classical mechanics. Okay?
I'm sorry, I will skip this.
So the idea is the following. I have these universal, what I am calling universal operators, and they are realized on the manifold in the form of what I am calling realized operators, and this realization process is factorized by classical observables. Okay? So let's take the observable Q, and let's suppose that a variation of Q is reflected in a variation of the realized operator. That is to say, the operator in Q is not equal, does not coincide with the operator in Q prime. This would mean that different states, Q and Q prime, realize the same universal operator differently. That is to say, the observable Q would specify the dependence of the realized operator on the state. Okay? The operator is realized differently in different points of the phase space. So the idea is that if this were the case, then this realized operator would be like properties of the state, in the sense that each state has a realized operator which does not coincide with the realized operator at other state. So they would be like properties of the state, so they would be something like a kind of eigenoperators. So what I'm trying to say with all this is that, in a sense, observables induce classical operators, because observables are nothing but quantities that specify how universal operations are realized on particular physical systems. For example, if I say that a certain system has a given energy, okay, this value of the energy simply tells me how this particular system realizes in a particular way a universal operation that I can call temporal evolution. Okay? It is like if this Lie algebra were like a Platonic realm of universal operators, and each particular system realizes these operators in a particular way. So what is a physical system? It is something that reacts in a certain way to temporal evolutions, to rotation, to translation, etc. That is to say, something that realizes in a particular way certain universal operations. Okay? Is it clear? More or less?
Just to clarify, so a system, two systems that are the same except they have different values of x, would realize translation in momentum in different ways? An example of what you mean?
System that differ in Q? What is the question?
So different values of position,
yeah,
of course, would be, so systems having those, one here, would realize momentum translation in different ways. That would you say, because that's, I mean, translation in momentum, boosting, is what's generated.
No, there is not necessarily. Maybe it will be clear in the next slide, not in the other one, okay? But if not, you can ask me again. So I will go back for a moment to my previous definition of what I understand by a physical object. I will say that a physical object is something that is characterized by the values of certain objective properties, okay? And what we have learned is that these objective properties can be characterized as something that specifies how the physical object realizes in a particular way certain universal operators, okay? So, afterwards, according to the postulate that we have proposed, we can interpret the action generated by these realized operators as automorphisms of the object. That means that the properties that are acted upon by these transformations are not objective properties, but only aspects. Okay? That is, a physical object is something that realizes, that has objective properties. These objective properties specify how the object realizes certain operations, and these operations are generators of automorphisms of the object, which act upon another properties, like, for example, here, the values of the coordinate Q. So this is the general idea of what a physical object is. So let's go now, if in classical mechanics this idea can be implemented. Well, in classical mechanics, a non-trivial transformation of the observable Q does not affect the realized operator VQ, because the Lie derivative of Q in the direction of VP is equal to 1, but the Lie derivative of VQ in the direction of VP is equal to 0. That is to say, I am transforming Q, but the realized operator does not change. Okay? And this is a consequence of the fact that in classical mechanics, the map between observables and operators is not injective. Therefore, different states in classical mechanics do not realize differently the same universal operator. This means that classical operators are not eigenoperators in the sense that, first, they do not depend on the state. They are not like properties of the state. And secondly, their actions transform classical states in other states that are physically different. That is to say, these operators do not generate automorphisms of the state. If I take a point in phase space and I perform a canonical transformation induced, for example, for P, I arrive to another state, which is not the same. So this transformation is not an automorphism of the state. Okay? Well, what about in quantum mechanics? In quantum mechanics, in fact, the map between observables and operators is injective. The consequence of this is that the operator P does not commute with operator Q. So in this case, it is true that physical observables specify how different states realize differently the same universal operator. Therefore, in this case, the realized operator is like a property of the state, because each state realizes the same universal operator differently.
Can you remind us what realized means?
Realized means that I have an element of the D-algebra of a group, okay? And there is a map between this universal structure and the phase space. Okay?
Yes.
So if I take a vector in the D-algebra, this vector is projected to different elements depending on what state in the phase space I take. Okay? So the realization is different for different states. And the objective properties specify how a state realizes this single element. Okay?
Okay, got it.
Well, in fact, if I consider the eigenvalue equation in quantum mechanics, I can read it like this. This equation states that P1 is an objective property of this object that specifies how the associated operator P is realized on the object. In other words, on this object, the operator P is realized as the multiplicative constant P1. Okay? That is to say, this state is something that realizes this operator in the form of this value. Or in other words, this particular objective property states how this object realizes this operator. So now the question is in fact, the transformation generated by these eigenoperators are or not automorphisms of the state? Well, in quantum mechanics, this is trivially true. If I consider the finite transformation of the eigenstate generated by P, this is trivially a gauge transformation. I'm just multiplying the state by a pure phase. That means that P is an eigenoperator that generates automorphisms of the state. The action of P does not change the state. So it is, in fact, an automorphism of the state. Well, the coordinate Q that is acted upon by the automorphism generated by P is, in some sense, pure gauge. And this is nothing but a restatement of the uncertainty principle. Okay? An eigenstate of the position has a coordinate Q that is pure gauge. So we can restate now the initial postulate by saying that the transformations generated by the eigenoperators associated to the objective properties of a physical object are only gauge transformations between different representatives of the object.
Can I come back to the previous one? That transformation depends on space, depends on Q.
Well, Q is only here, maybe I should have used another letter, is only a parameter which measures the how long I go with this finite transformation. This is finite transformation, okay? So it is the parameter which tells me to which point how far I will go, okay? So it's only a number. And this is a pure phase because this is an eigenvalue. This is an eigenstate of P, okay? So let's go back for a moment to classical mechanics. In classical mechanics, it is not possible to assume our postulate. That is to say, it is not possible to assume that the objective properties of a state generate automorphisms of the state. Why? Because since a classical state is defined by means of both Q and P, then the objective state should be defined, according to our postulate, modulo the gauge transformation generated by the classical operators associated to the objective property, that is to say, to Q and P. In other words, if Q and P allow us to identify the state, then according to our postulate, I have to gauge the state by means of the operator associated to Q and P, but the operator associated to Q gauges the coordinate P, and the operator associated to P gauges the coordinate, gauges out the coordinate associated to Q. This means that in this case, both Q and P would be pure gauge. There are too many gauge transformations. In this sense, all states in the phase space are only different representatives of the same physical state. That is to say, this is a gauge orbit, and this is also a gauge orbit. This means that all states in this phase space are the same physical state. So this is only to show that in classical mechanics, I cannot apply this postulate. That is to say, I cannot say that the objective properties of a state generate automorphisms of the state. Okay? In fact, the classical definition of a physical state is consistent only if we deny our postulate. That is to say, only if we deny that the action generated by an objective property is a gauge transformation. In fact, the meaning of canonical transformations in quantum mechanics is not very clear, because in principle, canonical transformations should only be transformations of the variable used for describing a physical state. Nevertheless, canonical transformations generated by physical observables have to be interpreted in classical mechanics as active transformation between physically different states. For example, if I consider the motion of a mechanical system, even if such a motion is only the continuous evolution of a canonical transformation, in classical mechanics it is interpreted as a transformation between states that are physically different. Time evolution in classical mechanics connects states that are different. So I cannot really interpret these canonical transformations as a transformations in the variables that I am using to describe the same physical state. So let me conclude. In quantum mechanics, contrary to classical mechanics, seems to be a satisfactory theory of physical objects. What do I mean? Well, quantum mechanics describe objects, if objects are understood in this sense. A physical object is a physical configuration that is defined by a set of objective properties that specify how certain universal operators are realized by the object. Okay? And such that these realized operators generate automorphisms of the object that permute its different aspects or profiles. The uncertainty principle is a natural consequence of this definition. If P is an objective property, then the observable Q acted outcome by the operator P is pure gauge. That is to say, it cannot also be an objective property. So we can say that classical description of physical system is not satisfactory, since non-objective properties are wrongly considered objective. In other words, classical states are overdetermined, or if you want, overcomplete. This is a consequence of the fact that in classical mechanics, the object automorphisms cannot be generated by the objective properties of the object. Hence, our postulate cannot be consistently implemented in classical mechanics. Therefore, the problem is no longer how to recover objectivity in quantum mechanics, but rather to understand how classical objects can be consistently defined. Well, so the conclusion is that quantum mechanics seems to provide a complete objective description of physical systems. Thank you.
Questions? This may have to do with your Goldstein quote, but it seems to me that if you want to just attribute reality to Q classically, and then you measure it in every successive moment of time, you can reconstruct P, and then you'd be hard pressed to.
In classical mechanics?
Yeah. In other words, you can get the trajectory to measure any position at all different times.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a problem with that in quantum mechanics because, the collapse postulate and what you end up doing to you don't get trajectories out. But that's not part of your picture of quantum mechanics.
No.
So I'm just really wondering about how, what would prevent somebody from insisting that, contrary to what you say, all these properties, Q's and P's are objective.
Well, maybe I can use the example of the particle that is moving. Let me propose the following argument. Let's suppose that you have a particle which is moving with a fixed velocity. Okay? Well, in a sense, the intuitive idea is that something, what is the uncertainty principle? The uncertainty principle tells me that if something is moving, well, this means that this something is has not a fixed location. Okay? If something is moving, by definition, it's not at a fixed place. Okay? So this could be, roughly speaking, a comprehension of the uncertainty principle. You could argue that, well, it is true that if something is moving, it doesn't have a fixed position. But you can say, okay, but let's pass to an instantaneous description.
What did you say? Instantaneous.
Okay. Yeah. That is to say, it is true that the system doesn't have a fixed position, but it does have a fixed position at each time. Okay? Well, according to my description, this system has a fixed energy, something which is moving with a constant velocity. But if energy is an objective property of this system, okay, this means that temporal evolution is a gauge transformation. But if temporal evolution is a gauge transformation, an objective property cannot change in time. But in this case, Q is changing in time. So this means that Q cannot be an objective property. Or in other words, the instantaneous description cannot be objective. Okay?
Okay. So then I'm a little confused as to what the objective properties are.
I'm sorry?
Then I'm wondering what the objective properties actually are, how to think about them.
Well, in this case, it is the energy and the momentum. What I am saying is it's not true in classical mechanics, so I cannot go to the end by analyzing a classical example with this postulate, because I have shown that I cannot interpret classical mechanics with these ideas. But in some sense, maybe this could be helpful to. Yeah?
It was Joe first, sorry.
I just wanted to clarify something. In the last two of your and more conclusions page, it said the problem is no longer how to recover objectivity. That is, assuming by that, you don't mean the measurement problem.
No.
You're not referring to
not at all. I think that you cannot, I'm not an expert in the measurement problem, but I think that it's not a problem that you can solve with an interpretation or with a conceptual comprehension of quantum mechanics, but rather with an effective modelization of a physical process that is very complex.
Yeah.
So,
you were talking about something different. So what is this, what do you mean by recovering objectivity?
Well, the idea that quantum states that not describe the effective state of affairs, that is something that, in general, it is commonly said that, well, in classical mechanics, we have a well-defined notion of physical object, and in quantum mechanics, there is something which is lost in the middle. Okay? So what I am saying here is that, in a sense, quantum objects are well-defined, but classical objects, I do not understand what the classical object is. That's why I'm saying that the problem is to understand how classical objects can be consistently defined.
Kelly first.
Yes. So I'm wondering if your talk is really Edward's talk in disguise, and that this is really a species of relationalism. That is, supposing my object is two particles, A and B, it seems it would follow from what you're saying that the center of mass position of the system A and B is not an objective observable, but the distance between A and B is.
Why?
Because the system could have a total momentum. What you're saying roughly is that half the properties are observable and half are not. And if I think about which are and which aren't.
Yeah.
You very conspicuously only discussed one object without any background or anything like that. So I'm proposing that if you discuss a set of objects, what you'll discover, I don't know because I'm not doing your analysis, but what you'll discover is that the objective properties are the same thing that Edward would call relational properties.
Because the things that are, if it, you know, if the total system has a definite momentum, then its center of mass position cannot be well defined, but its relative, the distance between the two, because objects could be well defined. And conversely, the total energy may not be well defined, the total momentum may not be well defined, but the relative momentum.
That is to say, you are saying that in some sense this conception is related with the relational lecture of mechanics.
My guess is that the reason why you start, you say things that sound reasonable, and then you reach conclusions which contradict everything that we think about the classical mechanics, and then I would answer, well, that's because you're only dealing with one particle, and if there was only one particle in the world, nothing that we do would make sense. We actually live in a world with many particles, and the things that we give objective properties to are relations between among those particles.
Yeah, but if I take a system with many, many particles, I can construct a phase space which describes that system, and I'm talking about that. What I'm calling here Q and P can be anything. I'm not talking about one particle. I'm talking about any system that can be described in classical mechanics.
So you're not
with the classical, with the Hamiltonian formalism.
So you're not accepting my invitation to make sense of what you're doing.
I do not see directly the relationship, but maybe it exists. I didn't think about this in those terms. Maybe it could work, but I don't know. At first I do not see the.
There's RB first, and then.
Well, I was just going to say, given that you haven't accepted that invitation, and I did wonder whether you shouldn't accept it. Given that you haven't accepted it, it seems that you've introduced a technical definition of objective properties, and you've discovered that it doesn't work in classical mechanics.
Yeah.
It does work in quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Why, therefore, is the conclusion not that your technical definition of objective properties is not universal?
Well, of course, I'm just saying. We have quantum mechanics, we have classical mechanics. In classical mechanics, the classical definition of an object is not satisfactory. Okay? There is something which is lacking. Okay? So I'm proposing a postulate which fills this gap, and I realize that quantum mechanics is a faithful implementation of this idea. And in a sense, this postulate is not, is, I would say, quite natural. The idea that the intrinsic properties of an object tell me what are the transformations that I can perform in order to observe different aspects of the object. That is to say, that I believe that is quite natural, this idea. It's not as old as it might seem. The idea is that it is the intrinsic nature of the object that prescribes how the object can manifest to different observers. So. But okay, it's a particular postulate.
Rafa?
I think several questions have expressed uneasiness about the relationship of this kind of definition, which looks to be more at a kinematical level, perhaps.
Yeah.
The dynamics of the system, starting maybe with Joe's question. So let me just ask it this way, or maybe this will help shed some light on it. If you were in the application of this view to quantum mechanics, is it important to be in the Heisenberg picture as opposed to the Schrodinger picture? Does it matter? Are you free to choose between them?
I think so, but the conceptual consequence of this idea is that if you have a system which is which has a well-defined energy, then the instantaneous state of the system has no objective meaning. That is to say, it is the whole temporal object which is well defined. If I want to take to see its different temporal profiles, that has no objective meaning. That was the example that I used to motivate my postulate. In fact, that if you have a temporal object to cut it in instantaneous images, it has no objective meaning. Only the whole temporal object is something that I can call an object.
Yeah, well, that sounds kind of like history state, but I still don't see. I mean, not every state is an eigenstate of energy.
Yeah, if the.
So suppose it's not, and we try to interpret your criterion of objectivity. Should we be doing it with the operators of the Heisenberg picture? or the Schrodinger operator, or does it not matter? I mean, that's the question.
I'm not changing anything in the formalism, so I do not see why it should forbid to pass one from one description to the other one. So I think that it doesn't matter. I think so.
Well, in one you have a state that has a time dependence, and the operators don't, and the other way.
Yeah, but
Do you want it to be an eigenstate of all the different Heisenberg operators? I mean, how many operators does it have to be an eigenstate of?
There is no difference between both descriptions. The only thing that I am saying is that if the state is not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, then in this case it is true that the instantaneous state of the state has a physical meaning. In that case, I cannot say that it is only the whole story, which is a well-defined physical object. In the extreme, where I have an instantaneous object, well, it is clear.
Any questions?
Yeah. Well,
that's almost every state is not an eigenstate of time.
Yeah, there is no problem. I was trying to think in the extreme example of something which has a well-defined objective property and the conjugated property completely undefined because it was simpler. But I think that the right way of speaking in the general case is in terms of unsharp objective properties, unsharp measurement, and unsharp, in this case, Gauss transformations. Yeah. And it's consistent. It's completely consistent. You have an objective property that is unsharp. This means that it generates an unsharp gauge transformation, which partially gauges out the conjugated variable. That means that the conjugated variable is, in some sense, also an objective property, which gauges out the first variable. So the circle closes as it should.
Don't want to go around in circles here, and it's basically the same issue, but you know, I wonder in what sense can we think of position or momentum as being intrinsic properties of a particle? Are Leibniz concerned they're defined relative to the rest of the universe and only relative to the rest of the universe? There's nothing intrinsic in them. The charge of a particle may be intrinsic.
Okay, but you can pass. I think that there is nothing changes if you pass to a constrained formalism where you have only relative quantities, and you can also work in a constrained Hamiltonian formalism where you have to restrict yourself to the constrained surface and you work with relative quantities, and you have well defined quantities that you can interpret it in this way. Nothing changes. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
That's why I do not. That's why I was saying that there is not a commitment here to relative mechanics. I think that you can say all this in a constrained context. Nothing changes.
One last question.
This is more of a comment, but I think it's quite relevant. It seems that what you've done is a beautiful little axiom that gives quantum mechanics as a preferred description for physical things over classical mechanics. And I know that's unpalatable to a lot of people, but I actually think that there's evidence from quantum information theory that this actually is the right way to look at the world, especially quantum cryptography, quantum key distribution.
That what is the right way?
This idea that quantum... okay, so the postulate that you wrote down,
yeah,
has quantum mechanics as being a theory of physical things.
Yeah.
Who has some, you know, they have some physical properties, but that this makes other properties not physical, just facets that
exactly
are realized temporarily. And this is a very nice motivation. We like to think of the classical world as being a theory of classical objective things. But really, when you look at quantum mechanics versus classical mechanics in an operational context of quantum key distribution, then you realize that when you interact with a quantum system, there is a minimal amount of stuff that you can't get away from intersecting with and affecting if you want to get information about it.
Okay.
And so in that sense, it whereas in classical mechanics this would never be true, you can always just copy it.
Yeah.
So I think that this is the sense in which quantum mechanics is actually about physical things. And it's brought about very nicely by this little postulate.
Yeah. Do you agree?
I do.
Okay.
All right, so let's thank you.